I'm Susan Cook Kittredge, and this is It All Depends. Sometimes the most difficult things we do pay off. When I was 18, I dropped out of college before the first day of classes. I was working as a reader at Random House, a job I figured Radcliffe graduates would envy, and I didn't want to give it up. When I told my parents my decision, they yawned and said, "Don't worry, you'll go when you want to." 20 years, two husbands, the second remains close at hand, and 5 children later, I needed God and decided to enter the ministry, but realized with a jolt, shoot, I forgot to go to college. Remember that part? Graduate schools require a BA. Thanks to Vermont College's adult degree program and an incredibly supportive family, I got my BA and Master of Divinity. Once a week, I put the kids on the bus, drove to Boston for an afternoon and evening class, took a nap, and headed home at 2 a.m., not something I'd likely do now. All in all, it took 10 years because with 5 kids at home, I went part-time. In the beginning, it felt overwhelming, like chopping down a California redwood with a Swiss Army knife. But when it was over, I looked back and thought with a shrug, that was a speed bump, because it was so worth it. Likewise, if after all the radiation and chemotherapy and surgery, you're declared cancer-free, then yes, it was hard, but worth it. This isn't always true. When, for instance, the shroud of past abuse continues to cloud light from your heart and your soul, the answer can be a resounding, very hard. It was hard then, and sometimes, alas, even harder now. But hard isn't necessarily bad. Unfortunately, I have yet to learn something really worthwhile easily. All we can do is pick up our Swiss Army knives and whittle away in the wild and crazy faith that healing rays of light will shine through the forest of our lives.
Hello, I'm John Kalacki, and the name of my piece is Spinal Journey. 20 years ago this month, life changed. MRI scans revealed a tumor inside my spinal cord. Surgery was scheduled. I was put under anesthesia at 7:30 in the morning. 8 hours later, my husband Larry was allowed into the recovery room. I was covered in blood and iodine, incoherent and screaming, paralyzed from the neck down. I did not feel pain or register temperature. Bladder and bowel control had ceased. I could not sit up by myself. Physical therapists prodded the misfiring circuitry. Ever so gradually, fingers began to unravel, toes to wiggle. One night, as friends were leaving, I surprised them by painstakingly raising one hand and faintly waving goodbye. The first time I stood upright, assisted with a walker and a leg brace, Larry and I wept with relief. Together with doctors and therapists, we set a goal to be home by the end of June. Crossing the threshold, I broke down in tears. I had learned how to walk up 6 stairs, so to be able to get up into the front door. Now, somehow, I had to climb 18 stairs to get to the second floor. Larry reassured me. I already knew how to navigate 6 stairs. I could rest in between. Over time, outpatient therapy expanded motor skills, coordination, balance, and strength. Even now, 20 years later, I immerse myself in ongoing physical therapy, swimming, water running, chiropractic, and massage modalities. I still don't have a balanced gait. Neuropathy persists in my legs, and I have little sense of touch, temperature, or location. I walk visually, with almost no kinesthetic relationship to the ground, necessitating using a cane. Throughout my spinal journey, I've learned about grace through the unwavering support of my family, friends, and colleagues. Not just their empathy, but also all of them caring enough to ask how they could help and generous enough to really mean it. To them, I'm forever grateful.
I'm Julie Kalish, and this is Radio Anonymity. I like to think that I'm invisible, not in a you-need-to-improve-your-self-esteem way, but in a comfortable anonymity kind of way, which isn't to say that I don't enjoy the pleasures of small-town Vermont living. For instance, I love going to the post office, that easy familiarity of offering a mutual, hello, fellow person who frequents the post office. I like that. It's more, at the spa the other day, the woman working reception greeted me by saying, hello, Julie. She's done this about 5 times now. It startles me every time. That I've been going to this gym for 16 years hardly seems reason enough to know something as intimate as my name. So it was a pretty big deal when I decided a couple of years ago to write my first radio commentary. Recording in Norwich was reassuring. It was just Betty down there in the basement studio, and the process itself was kind of fun. I also liked novelty, and the equipment was cool. But I listened to that first broadcast from underneath my bed covers. I've since convinced myself that radio might actually be a good setting for me. It's a disembodied voice sent out into the ether. If people happen to hear it, great. But then it's gone, vanished, ephemeral. Yeah, sure, the broadcasts are online, but I comfort myself with analogies about needles and haystacks. Plus, I've been told that there's video of me online, including apparently one of the worst panel experiences I've ever had. So now, through the blessings of the internet, I and countless others I've never met can listen and relive that 90 minutes in perpetuity. In short, I'm already pretending that any number of online things about me don't exist. How hard is it to add more? People do sometimes stop to tell me that they've heard me on the radio. It's weird, but I think I'm getting used to it. Plus, they've been friends who already know my name.
I'm Henry Holmeyer, and this piece is called Learning from My Dog, Daphne. Over the course of a lifetime, I've had 8 dogs. All but 2 of them I got as adult dogs that I'd rescued or inherited. First, there was Yankee Colonel II, also known as Bear. Colonel was a purebred boxer that my parents bought for $50 from a newspaper ad in 1954, when he was 2 years old and I was 8. The owners told my parents that someone had developed an allergy to him. Huh. I know now that the allergy excuse means that someone got tired of a dog's bad manners. But I loved Colonel and exercised him every day after school, throwing sticks until my arm grew tired. He had a lot of energy, probably from the sticks of butter that he stole off the table after breakfast each day when my mom walked my dad to the door. But he lasted till I went off to college, and he eventually stopped stealing food from the table, probably due more to arthritic hips than good manners. Then after college, when I was teaching 3rd grade, I got Leah, a black lab. She was a delight. Since I was also principal of the 5-room school, I made the rules. I decided that Leah would be a good addition to my class and brought her to school every day. Children would read to her or write her letters, which she answered the next day, allegedly with a crayon in her mouth. She was a great language arts teacher. Then 10 years ago, I got a puppy, a corgi that I named after a shrub, Daphne Miserium. Daphne is a delight, but very bossy, and she loves to bark when company comes. Always has, probably always will, even though I've tried almost everything to change her ways. Finally, I realized that having a relationship with a dog is a lot like having one with a person. You have to respect the basic nature of the individual. It took me 60 years, I guess, to figure that out. Was that really so difficult?
I'm Vic Henningsen, and this is profound, provocative, or just wrong? Commentary should be provocative, challenging listeners to think about something they didn't know or to reconsider something they thought they knew, but if we've done our job, now have to reconsider. That's hard in roughly 2 minutes, 45 seconds. Particularly for those of us given to long first drafts who must cut 1,500 words or more to get to the 350 to 400 in an average piece. As an historian, I'm inspired and deeply frustrated by Lincoln's power to be provocative and profound at Gettysburg in 277 words and about 2 minutes. And things don't always work as planned. My most provocative pieces happen by accident. I seem unintentionally to have discovered two surefire ways to evoke a Pavlovian listener response. One, and I know I'm not alone, is mentioning guns. Even the mildest reference incites a firestorm. Last fall, when I suggested sensible gun laws as a reasonable step to preventing domestic terrorism, followed immediately by a ringing pledge never to sacrifice freedom for security, gun advocates who liked my freedom remark tangled with other gun advocates objecting to my reference to gun laws. I call that inadvertently successful. But there's a less obvious and apparently automatic trigger that provokes incandescent tirades. People call. They even write me letters. That's any reference, no matter how slight, to Richard Nixon. He really is the Dracula of American politics. If I comment favorably, I'm tarred and feathered by those who believe you cannot drive a stake through his heart often enough. If I take a dim view, Nixon loyalists rise from wherever they lurk to denounce my distortion of history. It never fails. My favorite is a piece recalling the Senate Watergate hearings that elicited the wrath of nationally syndicated right-wing zealot Roger Stone, who posted this comment. Nixon was one of our greatest presidents. You, on the other hand, are just some beaded hippie. Have some more granola. Getting under his skin in about 2 minutes wasn't so difficult after all.
I'm Stephanie Green, and this is Heavy Metal. I used to be intimidated by heavy metal musicians. The tattoos and piercings, to say nothing of the noise, had me flooring it in the opposite direction. But then our beloved younger son got interested in it. As a young and talented guitarist, he sensed its musical possibilities. Despite its terrible reputation for twisting young minds, we opted to stay tuned and trust our kid. One of his first enthusiasms was Yngwie Malmsteen, the gold chain-draped Swedish heavy metal guitarist, whom I think of, perhaps unfairly, as the Liberace of metal. He didn't espouse anything particularly antisocial besides being loud,
And impressively, he wore more jewelry than I possess. Later, my husband and I attended performances of our son's band, Barishi. Wearing elaborate ear protection, in which we bore a striking resemblance to Mickey and Minnie Mouse, we were treated with surprisingly straight-faced courtesy by the bouncers. Some of them even congratulated us on our sensible precaution to safeguard what was left of our hearing. I avoid mosh pits and body slamming, but even that, I've observed, seems to be carried out for the most part with humor and remarkably good cheer. Once, I even saw a reveler, who seemed quite dangerous when in motion, stop and carefully rearrange a rug so no one would trip. In fact, the heavy metal players I've met have been astonishingly sweet, polite, and kind. Okay, the music isn't Mozart, and the intent is something else entirely. When I first saw Barishi perform a song called Jaguar Scarification Ritual, complete with the vocalist's backflip into the audience, I realized it was trance music. As a kind of group response to the aggravations of modern life and power abuses of all sorts, you get through the performance. On the other side, you're more peaceful. There's even something oddly cleansing about having just endured it. And you don't have to travel to the Amazon or Tibet to experience it. Not that difficult or heavy after all. Thank you.
My name is Peter Gilbert, and this is entitled Shackleton and the Great War. 100 years ago today, Ernest Shackleton's Antarctic expedition, which had sailed from England in 1914, just as World War I was beginning, was in great peril. Shackleton sought to be the first to bisect Antarctica, but it was not to be. Their ship, the Endurance, had become stuck in pack ice and eventually crushed like a walnut, leaving them camped on the ice for months, 350 miles from land. Their efforts to haul their lifeboats across the ice proved futile, but ocean currents slowly moved them north until they could get in their three boats and sail across the South Atlantic to Elephant Island, a tiny island of rock and rain and a few seals. There, Shackleton left 22 of his crew and headed with five companions in a 22-foot open boat for South Georgia, a speck of an island 800 miles away. Hurricane winds and poor visibility made celestial navigation extremely difficult. If they sailed past the island, they were done for. But incredibly, after 16 days, they threaded that tiny needle and landed on South Georgia, but on the wrong side. Currents wouldn't let them sail around the island, and so three of them climbed 17 miles over an unmapped, glacier-clad mountain range to arrive at the whaling station from which they had set off 17 months earlier. It then took Shackleton three attempts in borrowed boats before he succeeded in rescuing his men on Elephant Island. Miraculously, all 28 expedition members returned to England alive, in time for two of them to be killed in the war. Theirs is one of the greatest adventure survival stories of all time. The magnitude of what they had done, the audacity of the plan, the skill, the tenacity, courage, leadership, and luck that saw them all survive would be better understood with the passage of time and the end of the Great War. But then, many Brits who were seeing millions die in squalid trenches, gas attacks, artillery barrages, and machine gun fire might have been tempted to consider what Shackleton's men had done in the white silence of the Antarctic and ask themselves, was that so difficult? But the answer is absolutely.
Hi, Cindy Bittinger, Daring Women Who Wanted to Be American Presidents. There have been women before Hillary Clinton who made it their goal to become the first woman to occupy the White House. Each one made their own hammer to crack that glass ceiling. In 1872, Victoria Woodhull became the first woman to have a brokerage firm on Wall Street. She formed the Equal Rights Party with the goal of focusing on the need to give women the vote. Actually, she thought the 14th and 15th Amendments did give women the vote, and argued that before the Judiciary Committee of the House. However, a Supreme Court decision in 1875 did not rule that way, since suffrage was not a privilege of citizenship. In 1884 and 1888, Belva Lockwood also ran on the Equal Rights Party ticket, and famously stated, "I cannot vote, but I can be voted for." She was a lawyer who was admitted to argue before the Supreme Court after she lobbied Congress to pass an act relieving the legal disabilities of women. She was the first woman to have her name listed on a ballot and had electors pledge to her in 7 states. More than 75 years later, when women did have the right to vote and hold office, a brave woman from Maine tested the presidential waters again. Margaret Chase Smith was already a U.S. senator, so she had an established political office. And she had a friend in Vermont, Senator George Aiken, who made history by being first to place a woman's name in nomination for the presidency at a major party's convention. Smith's 27 votes at the Republican convention of 1964 did not stop Barry Goldwater's nomination. In 1968, Shirley Chisholm became the first African-American woman elected to Congress. She ran for the presidency in 1972, later declaring, "In this country, everybody is supposed to be able to run for president, but that's never been really true. I ran because most people think the country is not ready for a black candidate, not ready for a woman candidate." But she continued, "Someday."
Hi, my name is Ann Averett, and this is the second time around. Parenting is grand the second time around, much easier than that first go-round. As a grandparent, you can drop in to visit with hugs and kisses and then leave when you're tired. You can play and pretend and be young again, shedding 60 years with surprising ease. You can tell old stories about when you were a kid and no one rolls their eyes and sighs under their breath. Believe it or not, my granddaughter really is interested in knowing about life before TV and about my serious bouts of poison ivy. It's a mutual admiration society. If my 2-year-old granddaughter thinks I have angel wings, I feel the same way about her. And what can be more inspiring than being my 5-year-old granddaughter's favorite pirate? Grandparenting is a gift that keeps on giving. If you're lucky enough to have a second generation adolescent living nearby, your tech problems are solved. It's amazing how you can conquer the vagaries of the internet when you have a 10-year-old private tutor or a 14-year-old to put the smart in your smartphone. Of course, you do have to learn a new language in order to speak with your grandkids, and you better learn how to let your fingers do the walking. I worked in Washington for years and thought I'd mastered the acronym vocabulary when I could spin off EPA, FDA, and CDC, but that's child's play compared to the text lingo of LOL, laugh out loud, too cute, or too cute, and B-O-N, believe it or not. It all comes down to your point of view. If my son laments that a toddler who won't wear socks or a coat in a Vermont winter is stubborn, I have the luxury of suggesting she just has strength of character. Truth is, I can't really see what the fuss is all about. I don't think there's anything difficult about parenting the second time around.